So it is the book of Isaiah for the second last time. Don't know how that strikes you all, but we're looking this morning at Isaiah chapter 63, starting at verse 15, and then all of chapter 64. And I'd like to begin by reading these verses this morning. And then we'll look together. The text is printed on the top of the sermon outline, which you'll find on the back of your bulletin. Let me begin by reading the text this morning. Isaiah chapter 63, verse 15. Look down from heaven and see from your holy and glorious habitation. Where are your zeal and your mighty deeds? The stirrings of your heart and your compassion are restrained toward me. For you are our Father, though Abraham does not know us, and Israel does not recognize us. You, O Lord, are our Father. Our Redeemer from of old is your name. Why, O Lord, do you cause us to stray from your ways and harden our heart from fearing you? Return for the sake of your servants, the tribes of your heritage. Your holy people possessed your sanctuary for a little while. Our adversaries have trodden it down. We've become like those over whom you have never ruled, like those who were not called by your name. Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains might quake at your presence. As fire kindles the brushwood, as fire causes water to boil, to make your name known to your adversaries, that the nations may tremble at your presence. When you did awesome things, which we did not expect, you came down. The mountains quaked at your presence. For from days of old they have not heard or perceived by ear, nor has the eye seen a God besides you who acts in behalf of the one who waits for him. You meet him who rejoices in doing righteousness, who remembers you in your ways. Behold, you were angry, for we sinned. We continued in them a long time. And shall we be saved? For all of us have become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous deeds are like a filthy garment. And all of us wither like a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind take us away. There is no one who calls on your name, who arouses himself to take hold of you. For you have hidden your face from us, and have delivered us into the power of our iniquities. But now, O Lord, you are our Father. We are the clay, and you our potter. And all of us are the work of your hand. Do not be angry beyond measure, O Lord, nor remember iniquity forever. Behold, look now, all of us are your people. Your holy cities have become a wilderness. Zion has become a wilderness. Jerusalem a desolation. Our holy and beautiful house where our fathers praised you has been burned by fire, and all our precious things have become a ruin. Will you restrain yourself at these things, O Lord? Will you keep silent and afflict us beyond measure? This is the word of God to us this morning. It was 4 weeks ago we last looked at Isaiah in a sermon called Praying by the Book on July 8th. Some of you perhaps were here for that and saw there in the text immediately preceding these verses that I've just read, something about prayer, something about how to pray. We saw that we ought to think of prayer as reminding God to do what he said he will do. It's not literally a reminder. God doesn't literally need a reminder, but that's the way that the prophet Isaiah encourages us to think about prayer, taking what he has said and bringing it back to him as if to remind him of what he said. That means that we would pray biblically, because it's in the Bible we find what it is we are to remind God about. And along with the biblically, we should be praying reverently, we should be praying confidently. All of that wraps up to praying by the book. Now, I got a ringing up here that I'm not liking very much at all. I wonder if we can fix that. Thank you. So that was 4 weeks ago, praying by the book. We see this morning in chapter 63 and all of chapter 64, more of the prayer of Isaiah and an opportunity for us understand our own praying, to assess our own praying, and to learn how to pray more appropriately, more biblically, more like a prophet, simply by seeing how he prayed and thinking about imitating his prayer. So what I'd like to do this morning is show you in 5 ways how Isaiah prayed, so that you can see whether or not you're praying like a prophet, and you can learn to pray like a prophet. And of the 5 ways in which we will see Isaiah prayed, the 5th is, I think, the most important, the most fundamental. So I'll try to behave myself and make good use of my time and get to the 5th in short order, and then I'll give you an opportunity to see how to go about growing in this 5th aspect, which I think will be the greatest challenge as well as perhaps the most important element in prayer. So we're looking at praying like a prophet this morning. Let me show you five ways in which Isaiah prayed that we should imitate, that we should follow his example in, okay? You've got the notes on the back of your bulletin if you want to keep track. Praying like Isaiah means praying with, number one, an understanding of the great distance between us and God. This is really fundamental. This is where it starts. We've got to understand the great distance between us and God. The idea is all the way through the book of Isaiah. If you have any recollection at all of all that we've seen in these dozens and dozens of studies of Isaiah, you'll know that he spoke about God as the great and awesome God, far above him, far above us all. But it comes out of verse 15 of chapter 63 when he says to God in his prayer, "Look down from heaven." And the idea is that God is a great, great far distance above us. And if he's going to see us at all, he's got to look way, way down. Now, some of you are just the right age to remember the Friendly Giant. And when you watch the Friendly Giant, you had to look up, look way up. And I don't know how tall he actually was, but you had to look all the way up to the top to see him, right? Well, something very much like that in reverse has to happen if God is going to pay any attention to us at all. He's got to look down, look way down, and down in the depths of the universe, he would find us. In the Psalms, it says, "Who is like the Lord our God, who is enthroned on high, who humbles himself to behold the things that are in heaven and on earth?" It is actually a humbling experience for God to look on the heavens. You could sell your house, you could liquidate all your assets, you could buy the most expensive telescope that you could possibly afford and spend the rest of your life gazing up into the outreaches of the universe and continue to see new things. The universe that God has created is absolutely fantastic in its dimensions. It's huge. But God sits above it all and he humbles himself to look at it. We see some, you know, a little indication in a telescope that there's a galaxy unthinkable distances away, and it's unthinkably big. But for God, it's a humbling thing to look at it. He's made it, but it's humbling to look at it. And if it's humbling for God to look at the vast universe that he's created, then how much more humbling is it to focus his attention upon a little, quirky little, mostly watery planet called Earth? And then, I mean, you know what your hometown looks like when you fly over it at 30,000 feet, right? I mean, it's a little speck. So then look down at a little particular speck that is the city or the town that you live in, and then look further at the tiny little speck that is your neighborhood, and there's the tiny little speck that's you with all of your desires and all of your dreams and all of your ambitions and your praying to God. But you've got to bear in mind that when you're praying to God, you're praying to someone who's at a great distance from you. He's far above us because he's God. He's infinite in all his dimensions. And it's a humbling thing for him, an unspeakably humbling thing for him to even look at us, let alone for him to get involved in the details of our lives. Well, that's our God. We've got to understand the great distance between us and him. Not just the difference that comes from our different existences, him being infinite and us being finite, but there's more than that. There's the moral distance. You see in verse 6, which is in chapter 64, something of the moral distance. Isaiah says, "All of us have become like one who is unclean. Compared to the holy, holy, holy God, we're all diseased. We're all unclean." That's the word that refers to lepers. And in the thinking of those days, there was nothing that would make you more of a nobody than leprosy. And he says, we're all like that. We're all totally nobodies. Because of what? Because of our sin. All our righteous deeds are like a filthy garment, and all of us wither like a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, take us away. So we're a great distance from God morally as well as essentially. And we're a great distance from God relationally, because by nature, we just don't care much about God. If you've talked to someone who knows less about God than you get an idea of how little people naturally care about God. So verse 7, "There's no one who calls on your name, who arouses himself to take hold of you." If God suddenly had a new offer to the community, you know, something that was expensive is now free, no doubt there'd still be a lot of people who wouldn't care, because it's God. People just don't care about God. We're at a great distance relationally from God as well. And we must bear that distance in mind, or we'll pray wrongly. We'll be inappropriate in prayer if we act cozy with God. So there must be no flippancy in our praying if we're going to pray like a prophet. There's just no room for a casual remark towards God. You should never refer to him as the man upstairs or the big guy, or even somebody with a capital S when you say, well, somebody was looking after me. You should never be casual about God because he's at such a great distance from us. He's so much above us. I hope that has come through the whole study of Isaiah. I've called the series Isaiah's Vision of God's Greatness. I hope if anything has come through your gleanings from these 64 chapters looked at already, it's the greatness of God. That's the big thing that comes through. But while we're grappling with that and understanding that we are a great distance from God because he's so much above us, we need to understand at the same time and somehow hold it together with the first point, what is the second point, that praying like Isaiah means praying with an understanding of the great intimacy between us and God. So we've got great distance on the one hand, and somehow, strangely, at the same time, we've got great intimacy. Can you figure out how to spell that? There's a C in there somewhere. Intimacy. Verse 16 of chapter 63 shows us that, where Isaiah very simply says, "You are our father." Abraham doesn't know us. Israel does not recognize us. To some Bible commentators, that seems to be a reference to the New Testament application of this book. It's us who would be saying, God's our father, though Abraham doesn't know us, though Israel wouldn't recognize us, God's our father. And that may be what he's saying, and it may not be. But the point is, he's calling God his father. Now, if you have good positive vibes about father, the word, it's because your dad was a good dad. Even if he was a partially good dad, you might still have really good vibes about the word because where he failed you, you know that he could have done better. And if you got really bad vibes about the word father, then you're in trouble because the in your relationship with God, because you're supposed to relate to him as a father and you're supposed to have nothing but positive understandings about that. So, you know, whatever is true in your own experience, you've got to tweak your view of God as father and recognize that when it says father, it means all good stuff. Protector, provider, role model, hero, everything that a father could be that's positive, God is willing to be to his people. And that speaks of the great intimacy that is possible between any human being who approaches God rightly and God. Because although he's so distant as to humble himself even to look at us, he's willing to come to us not just as, you know, a distant God who's humbled himself. He's willing to come to us and have us call him Father. In fact, it's even cozier than that. In the New Testament, Paul the Apostle uses the word Abba, which means daddy. It's how babies speak of father. And God means to be that to us. He means to be our intimate father. If you're troubled by the apparent contradiction between him being so distant from us on the one hand and him being so intimate with us on the other hand, then look further at the details about the intimacy. And you see again in verse 16, he goes on, he says, "You, O Lord, are our Father." And then he says, "Our Redeemer from of old is your name." So not only Father, but he takes for himself the name Redeemer. A Redeemer means buyer out of slavery, purchaser. God has purchased us out of slavery. He's purchased us out of spiritual deadness so that he can be our Father. So, of course, this means that the intimacy is all about Jesus. It's all about what Christ has done, as God has come into the world in the form of his Son, has come into the world in the form of a man, and taken upon himself our sin, and died for our sin, that we could entrust ourselves to him and be forever his children, forever his sons and daughters, and experience that intimacy that comes from being redeemed by Jesus Christ. Well, I hope you can see where we're going with this. If we're going to pray like Isaiah, we need to pray with a few things in mind, and they must never budge from our minds. We must always be aware of the fact that we're talking to the great, infinite God who's far above us, so reverence is called for. But at the same time, if we have any right to pray at all through what Christ has done and what has been appropriated to us through faith, then our relationship with God should be one of intimacy. So flippancy is never right. Reverence is always necessary, but a kind of coldness or a kind of formality isn't right either. He's to be Father to us. He's to be Daddy to us. He's to be the one we love. There's to be an intimacy going on there. And both of those things need to be held in our minds at the same time if we're to pray rightly. And that's not all. We can go on. Now, point number three, to pray like a prophet, to pray like Isaiah, means praying with an understanding of our great dependence upon God. Now, this should come from adding the first and the second point together, as one and two makes three. So the third point, the dependence, comes out of the view that he's altogether greater than us, but he's made a relationship possible with him, and it's all dependent upon what Christ has done for us. And if Christ hadn't done so much for us on the cross and done it perfectly, we would not have a right to a relationship with him. So we're entirely dependent upon him. We need an understanding of our great dependence upon God is the third point. And we see that all the way through the text. We see it in the fact that we call God our Father, again in verse 8. Now, O Lord, you are our Father. And in a good setting, children are very dependent upon their fathers. So we have something of our dependence wrapped up in that word. But it goes on from that. Verse 8 says, we are the clay, and you are our potter. And our worship time has given us an opportunity to reflect upon that already. Think about how dependent upon the potter the clay is to be anything. Find a piece of clay that's got anything going for it at all, and you know there's been a potter there. And you don't pat the clay on the back and say, that's the most beautiful vase-like appearance you've taken on lately. I give you all the glory. You're a clever piece of clay. And he would say, no, don't thank me. It's the potter who gave me this slender neck and a little spout and handle. So it's all the potter, right? So any good thing in us, we don't deserve credit for it. God gets the credit because we're just the clay, and he is the potter. And we are the work of his hand. We are his workmanship, his work of art. That's very, very clear in verse 8. But other references in the text speak in other ways of how dependent upon God we are. Back in verse 15. Where are your zeal and your mighty deeds, the stirrings of your heart and your compassion restrained toward me? When you think about that for a minute, you realize that's a reference to our dependence upon God, because the people of God were suffering from this horrible lack of zeal. They didn't care about God at all. And Isaiah says, where's your zeal, God? And what he's saying is the people aren't zealous, but we're dependent upon you for the zeal. If we're going to be holy people, if we're going to have a zeal for God, it's got to come from God. So he looks to God, and it almost sounds wrong, but he looks to God and says, the people aren't zealous. Where is your zeal? The people aren't excited about you. Where are your mighty deeds? The whole act of praying is an expression, in fact, of our dependence upon God. In every case, as we pray, we're expressing to God the fact that we are dependent upon him for something or other. Verse 19, we've become like those over whom you've never ruled. Isaiah looks at the people of God, and then he turns to God. He says, what a mess. These people are nowhere. What are these people like? He says, oh, they're like people who've never known God. And you see the expression of dependence upon that? Dependence upon God? He says, these people are a wreck. They look like people who don't know God. So it's only in knowing God, it's only in getting close to God that they ever have become anything other than a wreck. And now they look like people over whom God has never ruled. So they look, totally worthless. They look disorganized and lost and befuddled and empty. And all of this is an expression of our dependence upon God. Now, if you've been working away and understanding the Bible for a while, that understanding the Bible properly requires a balance. We've looked at one already this morning. You've got to balance the great distance between God and us with the intimacy that God requires, and hold those two together somehow. Well, there's lots of things that have to be held together. Jesus Christ is both God and a man. They got to be held together. A classic of understanding is to hold together the idea that God is entirely sovereign, that he's in control of all things, with the fact that human beings are held responsible for their actions. That's a real biggie, and it requires a lot of thinking through to sort of how it could be that God will hold us responsible for our actions while he is in fact in control of all things. But you really got to hold on to both, or you'll miss big boatloads of truth. Well, it's interesting when you see Isaiah, who's giving us a vision of his greatness, how close he comes. He doesn't get there, but how close he comes to actually denying human responsibility in order to assert the sovereignty of God. Now, that's always a mistake. To rule out responsibility is a mistake, but it's interesting, intriguing to see how close Isaiah comes to actually doing that as he's expressing our dependence upon God. Look at verse 17, which is part of that, the first chapter, 63. He says to God, in verse 17, why, O Lord, do you cause us to stray from your ways? You see what he's saying there? The people were wandering. We've been seeing that for chapters after, tens and tens of chapters. We're in chapter 63 now. The people are a disaster. They've been wandering away from God. And there's all sorts of reasons why they're wandering away from God. They love idols. They hate God. They love wickedness. They think sin is fun. They hate holiness. There's all sorts of reasons why they are responsible for their wandering. But Isaiah says in verse 17, "Why, O Lord, do you cause us to stray from your ways?" And he's seeing through all of the human explanation, which accounts for responsibility. This is probably the way to say it. He sees through all the things that make us responsible for our actions to the fact that behind it all there is a God who holds us together, upon whom we are entirely dependent, upon whom our life depends. And he says to God, you know, ultimately I can link, this is what he's saying, ultimately I can link what you have done and not done for these people to how these people are behaving. So he's looking to God and saying, why have you caused us to stray from your ways? And he goes on, why have you hardened our heart from fearing you? The people don't fear God. Their hearts are hard towards God. There's all sorts of human explanation for why they've hardened their hearts and how they have personally hardened their hearts. But Isaiah can see through it and say, but you know, in the final analysis, God is the ultimately responsible one. And all of that is an expression of our total dependence upon God. It's not like Isaiah is the only one who's ever said that. Back in the book of Deuteronomy, we get it from Moses, where there's a reference in Deuteronomy 29. Pretty plain statement of the fact that the people won't fear God till God gives them fear, and it's his decision not to give them the fear of the Lord. They won't believe until he gives them faith, and it's his decision not to give them faith. Get the same thing in the New Testament, Romans chapter 1. The people of the world are doing all kinds of horrible and depraved wickednesses. Why? Romans chapter 1, because God has given them over to do wickedness. There's a strong element of sovereignty in the sovereignty of God in regard to the things that people are responsible for. And it's all quite mysterious. But if anything comes through, it is this thought of our great dependence upon God. We are entirely dependent upon him. And never mind the theological conundrums that develops for now. Just think practically about that. In Acts chapter 17, speaking to a group of non-believers in the city of Athens, Paul the Apostle says with great authority, in him, in God, we live and move and have our being. We're entirely dependent upon him for our living, for our moving, for our existence. Everything comes down to whether God wills. We're entirely dependent upon him. And so Hebrews chapter 1 says that Christ, who is the person of God working in the world, holds all things together by the word of his power. He holds everything together by his sovereign word. So you can't escape this truth, nor should you want to try to escape this truth. We are entirely dependent upon God. And when we pray, we don't come with any kind of bargaining chips. We don't come and say, well, God, here's the deal. If you do such and such, I'll do such and such for you. That kind of praying is completely inappropriate, because everything we do is ultimately from God, just as much as everything he is to us comes by his grace to us. And the great thing about praying in regard to understanding our dependence upon God is that nothing is impossible, because we are praying to the one who makes everything happen, who is capable of all things, who holds all power. So we should be very interested in praying, because in praying we make connection with the God upon whom we're entirely dependent and who can do all things, as seen by the fact that he has done all things that have occurred so far. So here, hold all these things together. God is great distance from us, so we need to be reverent. He's right close to us in intimacy of a father and child relationship, so we should be very honest and transparent with God. We're entirely dependent upon him, so we should be humble and expectant as we come to our great God. And as we're trying to hold those things together, let's go on to the fourth point, which gives us help with the three previous points, and that is, in the fourth place, praying like Isaiah means praying with an understanding of the history of God's dealings with people. The more clearly we see what God has done in the past, the more able we are to understand what God means to do for us in the present and in the future. So in verse 3, we see Isaiah remembering some of his history lessons. He says in verse 3, when you did awesome things which we did not expect, you came down, the mountains quaked at your presence. He remembers some particular earthquaking experience that the people of God had with God. He remembers that. And that brings him to a conclusion of verse 4. For from days of old they have not heard or perceived by ear, nor has the eye seen a God besides you. There's no God besides you who acts on behalf of the one who waits for him. An understanding of the history of God's dealings with his people will convince us over and over again, and more deeply and more intensely convince us that there's no one like God, and that God is entirely to be trusted. And we see that more and more clearly as we understand the history of God's dealings with people. So we have page after page after page in our Bibles of explanations of how God has interacted with his people and how God has interacted with those who are not his people. Over and over again, the history of God's people, not just because it's so interesting, not because it's quirky, but because it's instructive to us. It helps us to understand what we should expect from God. None of the stories in the Bible are put in so that we can understand, well, that's happened, so it'll never happen again. God was like that once, so you don't ever think he'll be like that again. Oh, quite the opposite. The things that the Bible contains are all written for our instruction. The Apostle Paul makes that really, really plain. He says so, for example, in Romans chapter 15. He says, whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope. We're supposed to be people filled with hope. Where does the hope come from? From our confidence that God hasn't changed and our knowledge of what God was like in times past. So the more clearly we understand the Bible, the more able we are to relate to God properly and to pray properly. And then besides the Bible, there's all of, you know, all of history and God's dealings with people in history. And so next to reading the Bible, reading books about God's dealings with people through his servants in centuries past is very, very valuable. Read, for example, the history of the Methodist revival. And most people these days would say that the whole Methodist thing got started by John Wesley, and he was certainly a leading person. But read the actual 18th century accounts, and you'll see that it was all started by a little cross-eyed guy named George Whitefield. And the power of God was upon that man in such force that the whole of England turned around while Europe was going through all its upheavals, and France was, you know, going through its reign of terror with the French Revolution, the guillotine, and all that sort of stuff. England was held back from the destruction of that upheaval at that time by the revivals that occurred through this little guy named George Whitefield, who stood up and preached the gospel. And the whole of England was turned around. And it's a remarkable demonstration of what Isaiah was saying here. When you did awesome things, which we did not expect, you came down, and people have never heard or perceived or seen with their eyes a God besides you. And your own personal experience can help you with that as well. For as you experience God in your life, you grow confident that your dependence upon God is well placed, and that there's nothing that's impossible to you, and there's no God like our God, and so we should pray. Now, all of these things, all of these understandings are important to praying properly, but perhaps none of them are as important as this fifth point, which I think comes out loud and clear in the text. So point number five, praying like Isaiah means praying with a passion for his glory, a passion for his glory. And you see that passion in verse 1 of chapter 64 in that little word, oh. He doesn't say, it would be good if you rend the heavens and come down. He doesn't say, let me go on record as desiring the heaven-rending experience that we've seen in the past and your visitation among us. But he says it with passion. He says it with a heartfelt intensity. He says, oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down. There's a lot of passion packed into that verse, and if you read on, you'll see that he doesn't stop but continues. For example, as the prayer ends, and you read between the lines, verses 9 to 12, he's speaking with this great heartfelt desire to get God moving on the basis of the fact that the people of God are such a sham and such an emptiness compared to what they should be. So verse 9, don't be angry beyond measure, O Lord, or remember iniquity forever. Behold, look now, all of us are your people. Your holy cities have become a wilderness. Now that may not sound like a passionate thing for you to read, but understand the commitment they had to the holy city, the view that the holy city was the display of God's glory. And he looked at the holy city prophetically. He looked into the future and saw it was a wilderness. And you can sense the ache as he says, your holy city has become a wilderness. Zion has become a wilderness. Jerusalem, the center of the universe, the city of the living God, has become a desolation. And he is very obviously horrified by this, and his horror results in a prayer to God of passion. Our holy and beautiful house where our fathers praised you has been burned by fire. All our precious things have become a ruin. Will you restrain yourself at these things, O Lord? He prays with passion. And if we are to pray like a prophet, we are going to need to pray the same way, with intensity. There's no room for a kind of matter-of-fact statement of need when we come to God, because the things that we should be praying about are important things. And if we have any right to pray about them at all, they should be ripping our hearts apart, and that should show up in how we pray. There are certain things in life that must be done with passion if they're to be done at all. I'm reading these days a novel called Middlemarch. Confession is Good for the Soul. It was on my reading list in third year university, and I'm just getting to read it now. I passed the course, and perhaps I should fess up to my professor, but that's how studying English literature goes. In Middlemarch, which is all about a little community called Middlemarch in England in the 1830s, there's a wizened up old intellectual genius named Edward Casaubon. He's really, really old. He's 46 years old, it says. And he takes a liking to this beautiful young woman in her 20s, and he decides to propose marriage to her. And he's a scholar, so he puts the marriage proposal in writing. Here's how Edward Casaubon proposes marriage to Dorothea Brooke. "My dear Miss Brooke, I have your guardian's permission to address you on a subject than which I have none more at heart. I am not, I trust, mistaken in the recognition of some deeper correspondence than that of date in the fact that a consciousness of need in my own life has arisen contemporaneously with the possibility of my becoming acquainted with you. For in the first hour of meeting you, I had an impression of your eminent and perhaps exclusive fitness to supply that need, connected, I may say, with such activity of the affections as even the preoccupations of a work too special to be abdicated could not uninterruptedly dissimulate, and each succeeding opportunity for observation has given the impression an added depth by convincing me more emphatically of that fitness which I had preconceived, and thus evoking more decisively those affections to which I have but now referred." The letter goes on for quite some time. It gets really hot in the middle. Here's the hot part. Apologize to those of you who have brought children. "I have discerned in you an elevation of thought and a capability of devotedness which I had hitherto not conceived to be compatible either with the early bloom of youth or with those graces of sex that may be said at once to win and to confer distinction when combined, as they notably are in you, with the mental qualities above indicated." Later on, "Such, my dear Miss Brooke, is the accurate statement of my feelings, and I rely on your kind indulgence in venturing now to ask you how far your own are of a nature to confirm my happy presentiment. To be accepted by you as your husband and the earthly guardian of your welfare, I should regard as the highest of providential gifts. I await the expression of your sentiments with an anxiety which it would be the part of wisdom were it possible to divert by a more arduous labor than usual. In any case, I shall remain yours with sincere devotion, Edward Casaubon." Well, you know, I'm happy to report that the young lady was quite taken by this marriage proposal. She thought that it would be far more significant for her to become the wife of a scholar who lived far above the emotional plane of the ordinary human being than to live with an ordinary guy who was crazy for her. So she hastily married him, and very soon found, two or three weeks into the marriage, that it wasn't so much a matter of fact that he was, you know, living above the realm of emotion, but more that he was sort of living quite outside the world of emotion, that he wasn't actually capable of any of the kind of passion that you would expect in an earnest marriage proposal. I don't know what's going to happen to them. I'm only halfway through the book, and maybe they'll work it out. But the point would be, this is no way to propose to a lady. Note it down, young man. This is not what you want to do when it comes time to propose in marriage. We want, in our understanding of marriage, we want some passion. We want some intensity. We want the man desperate for the woman's affection and pleading with her to complete his life by, well, you know how this works. It's just totally inappropriate to sort of stand back and serve notice that it would be appropriate at this time to form a marital union for the above reasons. So if all of that's agreed upon, if that's what we see, what do we say about God and prayer? Is there a place for a matter-of-fact prayer? Is it ever right for us to come to God and sound like Edward Casaubon? "Inasmuch as you have revealed yourself to be the infinite God, perfect in all of your attributes, both those communicable and incommunicable, I hereby, your creation, serve notice that you are worthy of my praise." Would it ever be right to do that? I think you could see, no, it never would be right. Would it ever be right to pray that God would heal this mended world in a sort of matter-of-fact way? Lord, upon my observances, I see that the world is a mess. Please fix it. That would never be right. It would be like a cold marriage proposal. It would be like a business transaction between us and God. It says here, I should pray, dear God, I am now praying. That would not be right. So what needs to happen is that we need to learn, if it's not something we know naturally how to do, we need to learn to be passionate in prayer. And so now I want to spend what's left of my time speaking about how that's going to happen, where the passion comes from. Well, no surprise, considering our dependence upon God, it comes from God himself, because it's a good thing. And James the Apostle says every good thing comes from the Father of lights, comes from above. So if we're going to become passionate in prayer, it's because God gives us a passion. So you ought not to go looking. You ought not to hold off on prayer until you develop a spiritual passion. You know, no one has the excuse of saying, I'm not praying this year because I'm developing some passion for God. And once I get the passion, I'll start praying. No, it comes from God himself. And God doesn't hear work by simply declaring it. You know, when he created light, he just said, let there be light. And there was light. But he doesn't create passion the same way. He has means by which he creates passion. And there are three principal means, which I want to show you this morning, giving you something to do in order to grow in your passion for his glory in the week ahead. It comes from God himself through his word. We need to be people of the book. We need to be people of the Bible, because it's through the Bible, which is like a sword, which is like a lamp, which is like a fire, that our hearts are set on fire, that our hearts are cut open, that the light shines. And some of you would be stuck at this point because you say, well, I've tried to read the Bible and I find it really dull. Or I read the Bible, it's intellectually stimulating, but it just makes me more and more intellectual and academic. You know, I don't develop a passion through the Bible. Well, that's because you're misreading the Bible. If you're reading the Bible properly, it's setting your heart on fire. So how do you learn to do that? How do you develop a taste for that? Well, there's the word, taste. Peter says we should long for the pure milk of the word after we have tasted and seen the kindness of God. It's a matter of developing a taste. You develop a taste for the word, which develops a hunger and a love for the word, which develops in you a passion for God. How did you get to like olives? Those of you who like me like olives. If you remember your first experience with olives, it probably wasn't positive. But somewhere along the line, you got the idea that it would be good to like olives, so you persevered, gagging down these things, until eventually you found a way to like them. And then you say, ooh, olives. Right? So how'd you get to like coffee? You probably drank tea with your parents, loaded with sugar and milk, and they drank coffee, and you wanted to be like them, so you started drinking coffee. Do you remember what coffee tastes like when you first started tasting it? I remember tasting horrible, but I had the vision. It's going to be a coffee drinker. Stunt my growth. So I started drinking it. And after a while, I started, hey, I kind of like this stuff. My very favorite novel in the whole world is The Lord of the Rings. And I confess now that I started it four times before I ever made it through to the end, because I didn't like it at first. Oh, little hobbits, furry feet, what's that? I didn't like The Lord of the Rings until I got into it. And then getting into it developed a love for it. I've read that book 20 times now. I adore that book. I love olives and coffee. Sometimes I'll have some olives, coffee, drink, read Lord of the Rings. That's a high moment for me. But it's all stuff that I've developed a taste for, right? So who likes the Bible? People who have developed a taste for the Bible. And that means you discipline yourself to get into it so that you develop a taste for it, so you develop a longing for it, and out of that comes a passion for God. Similarly, passion for God's glory comes from God himself through worship. It comes through worship. And similarly to the Word of God, some people will say, well, at this point I stop because I just, you know, I don't get that. In fact, I would think that very many people new to the church, any church that's worshiping well at all, would say, I don't get it. I don't see what's going on. You know, all this stuff, you know, there's hands raised, there's eyes closed, there's people moving around. What's that? And you want to say the same thing, you have to develop a taste for it. But besides that, you have to develop something else. And that is, you have to develop, well, no, let me just leave it at that. You have to develop a sense, a taste for what it's all about. And what it's all about develops and grows through experience. Like, let me be really racy. How are babies born? Babies are born because people develop a taste for physical affection. Let me not get too far with this. But, you know, first of all, there's a kiss. Ooh, that was...